Hello. It is time for us to get started. My little clock has started clicking down. So hello, everyone. I'm Ben Armstrong, here to talk about what's new in Hyper-V. Before I get started, I do want to give one disclaimer, and that is about half an hour my demo rig just blew up. So we will see how we go on demos. I still am going to attempt to do some demos for the curious. Just before coming on here, I was like, time to just check out the demos one last time. And I pulled up my demo environment, and every account in my domain just tripped over the password expiry. And so all my domain-based demos started failing, and every time I logged in, it was asking me to change passwords, and of course I have those coded into all my scripts. So I have madly reset passwords, I've put them back on, the system is trying to build itself right now. We'll see how we go, but I may have to skip over some of the demos. We'll just have to play it as we go. So what is this session about? This session is here to talk about everything that you can do with Hyper-V in the technical preview 3 of Windows Server 2016. So quick show of hands, how many people here have actually played with the technical preview 3 build? Downloaded it, installed it? Okay, about a quarter. I would really encourage people to get out and play with it. There's a lot of cool technology in there. And there's just let me put it this way. We are just going to be putting more and more features in there as time goes on. As I have on here, this is not a comprehensive overview. So if you are struggling to keep up with trying out the new features, we intend to make your life harder in the future, not easier. So there's no better time to start playing. More importantly, and this is the reason why we put out these technical previews, is we want to hear from you whether these features are working for you, if they do what you need, if you need us to make changes. So please play with them, give us feedback, come to the forums, come to User Voice, and let us know what's going on. Something to highlight, many of these features are in Windows 10, and we actually have some features that we've been flighting to Windows 10 that I'll be talking about as we go through with this. So if you're more of a Hyper-V on desktop person than a Hyper-V on server, there's lots of cool stuff here as well. So with all that, you know, to kind of set the stage, we've done a huge amount of work in Server 2016 for Hyper-V. And what's been behind driving like the vast majority of the work has been what can we do with Hyper-V to just continue to make it a great platform for cloud environments, both public and private, you know, hybrid and hosted. And there are a number of things I'll call out as we're going through where I'm like, this is really a big deal for private cloud. This is really a big deal for public cloud. So you'll see that as we're going through. But in making cloud great, we then break that down. There's a whole set of categories that we've looked at for making cloud great and making Hyper-V a great environment for cloud. So the first area we focused on was enabling new cloud deployments to be the best environments they could possibly be. And here we have two major investments. The first one is Hyper-V on Nano Server. Now, I'm going to do a show of hands that's going to make me happy, and then I'm going to do a show of hands that's going to make me sad. So, happy show of hands. How many people have heard about Nano Server? Yay! Happy. How many people have tried it? Yeah, sad. Please, and in all honesty, if nothing else, if you do nothing else after this, please go and try out Nano Server. So I'm going to spend a little bit of time on this slide because I'm going to really try and sell this to you guys. So the first thing that I want everyone to be aware of is when Windows Server 2016 comes out, the Hyper-V team is going to be putting out a lot of material and a lot of messaging saying, we recommend Nano Server as the default host for Hyper-V. This is going to be our best practice recommendation. Now, some inside information, we've actually been working on Hyper-V on Nano Server for quite a long time now. This has been something that we've been working on this for long before anyone here has heard of Nano Server, and we have done a lot of testing and, you know, validation of Nano Server. I was meeting with a customer this morning, and they were actually asking me about this. And one thing that I am really proud of, just from an engineering point of view, is in Windows Server 2016, the binaries, the files, the executables that make up Hyper-V, we run exactly the same files whether you're running full server or nano server. There's no differentiation. It's the same files, the same features, the same capabilities. However, the differences are drastic. So let's go through some of the differences of nano server. So the first one is you deploy a Hyper-V nano server environment. It uses 500 meg of disk. That's it. No, 500 meg of disk. For the host operating system, for all the virtualization components and the host operating system, we use less than 256 meg of RAM. So very lightweight, very special purpose. And crucially in all of this, we've been building on this for a while. We've been gathering statistics. We've been profiling it. So we know over the last 24 months, if you had a full installation of Windows Server and you had Hyper-V on there, you had to patch and reboot that server 22 of the 24 months. If you were running Server Core, you had to patch and reboot that server 15 of the 24 months. If you were running Nano Server, you had to patch and reboot that server three times in the last 2 years. So this is really important to get your head around. Now, one of the big things, and I'll be like honest and transparent, like we've been pushing Server Core for a while, and everyone, actually, here's a fun show of hands. How many people here are running Hyper-V in their environments today? Great. How many of you are doing it on Server Core? That's more than I was expecting, but I'd say about 20% on Server Core. And the story that I hear time and time again is like, yeah, we tried Server Core, but it was easier to manage with the full desktop. And I would really encourage that as you're thinking about Server 2016, start thinking about what's it going to take to manage these systems remotely. A little personal experience for me, so I run crazy infrastructure in my house. I run RTM, so it's currently I've got a bunch of servers running Hyper-V 2012 R2. Recently, I had to rebuild a bunch of the hardware, so I had to strip them down, put them together wrong, turn them on, have them beep at me angrily, pull them apart, put them back together right, and boot them up. You know what you do when you work on servers. You never put them together right the first time. I don't know what the deal is with that. But I did this on one of the servers, and then I was thinking, man, like, what's this going to be like when we release Server 2016 and I'm using Nano? So for the rest of the servers, what I actually did was I went through and I set them up so that they didn't have a screen attached, and I could only do it with remote management. And it was an interesting experience. I was able to do it. I got all the remote management tools set up. I got the server remote management toolkit. I set up PowerShell remoting. But it's something that you have to get into the habit of doing. Otherwise, when you start looking at Nano Server, you're going to be like, I don't know how to do anything. And this is something you can do today, is you can start thinking about what does it look like to manage these systems remotely. But as I said, really encourage. We have some great getting started guides for nanos. We have some scripts that will get you set up and running really easy. Please, please, please start looking at this. The second thing, of course, that we've been working on for this is the container technology. I'm not going to talk much more about it other than this slide. I had an entire session on it yesterday. If you didn't go, I apologize. You missed out. But this is some really exciting technology that we have coming out. So that's sort of the stuff that we're doing for built in the cloud environments. But the next thing, and this is, there are so many things. I get people criticize me because I do this session, and I'm like, this one excites me, and this one excites me, and I'm an excitable person. So this does excite me, is the work that we've been doing on security. Now, as I mentioned in the keynote yesterday, we live in a world where there is a rising tide of security attacks and exploits. And this becomes particularly challenging when we look at cloud environments. Now, while the number one concerns that we hear when people look at using hosted cloud or public cloud is, how can I trust that my daughter is safe? And how can I meet the regulatory requirements that are on me to protect my data? And prior to Server 2016, most of our customers, most of our users looked at this problem and said, this is not something that you can solve, Microsoft. This is a governmental issue. This is a policy issue. This is not a technology issue. And so we actually came back and said, actually, no, we think this is something we can solve. Let's see if this demo works. Come on, little computer. I'm a little scared. The hard drive is going crazy. So let's see. Nope, that build script. I'm going to have to try and do this old school. My build script has fallen apart. So let's see. Bring up this virtual machine. I'll just say the state my laptop is in, be happy if I pull off any demos. So every demo is going to be a success. So here I have a virtual machine. Yay, you know, we've all seen this a million times. Look, I've got a virtual machine. It's running Windows 10. Exciting. But what's different about this virtual machine is this virtual machine actually has a TPM in it. Because we're enabling the ability to have virtual TPMs in virtual machines. And using that TPM, I've enabled BitLocker on this virtual machine's virtual hard drive so that the data is fully encrypted and protected. We also have done some work. Now, as you heard me talk yesterday about the work that we've done in Secure Boot to allow you to protect your systems from kernel mode attacks. We've been working with the Linux community to bring that same technology to Linux. So here I have, can I remember my password? Probably going to get this wrong 3 times. Yes. So here I have a Linux virtual machine. Which has Secure Boot enabled. So I just looked, this is a script that greps the devices and returns that Secure Boot is enabled. If I come into the settings, you'll see I have Secure Boot enabled, and I've selected to use the Microsoft UEFI Certificate Authority, which is what you need to use for a Linux environment. So I can have the same level of kernel mode protection. So these are two examples of things that we're doing to allow you to protect these workloads even when they're running in virtual machines or in cloud environments. So what I just showed you was a virtual machine with a TPM in it. And that is a great technology for letting you encrypt the data and protect the data, and so that if someone gets access to that virtual hard drive, they can't get access to the data. But that's actually not the entirety of what we're delivering in Server 2016 in this space. The end-to-end story that we're delivering is a technology that we call shielded virtual machines. And shielded virtual machines actually brings together three separate pieces of technology into one overall story. The first piece of technology is the virtual TPM and the support for BitLocker that I just showed you. The second thing is, you know, yesterday I demonstrated Credential Guard, where I showed you how we were able to use the hypervisor to protect, you know, your user credentials from an administrative process. Well, we've been able to use the same technology applied to virtual machines. And here what we can actually do when we create a shielded virtual machine is we can say, okay, you're going to create a virtual machine and you're going to run it either on a server in your data center or you're going to run it in a server at a hoster, and we're going to shield that virtual machine so that even the host administrator on that Hyper-V server cannot interfere with your virtual machine. And that's a really important concept. You know, and there's like, we want to get to a world where, you know, it doesn't matter if, you know, you don't have 100% trust with your hoster, he can't get to your virtual machine. Now, another, like, and I've been talking to a lot of customers this week, you know, not everyone, but, you know, a couple of the customers I've talked to, I start talking about their data center operations, and they've outsourced the operation of their data center. So the people who have host administrative access to their Hyper-V servers are not employees of their company. And this is a technology where you can go, okay, they aren't employees of the company. I want them to be able to do Hyper-V maintenance and administration, but I want to ensure that they cannot access the data inside the virtual machines in any way, shape, or form. And that's the second pillar of the shielded virtual machine. The third pillar of the shielded virtual machine is this host guardian service. And what the host guardian service allows you to do is it allows you to say, you know what? The keys that are used to encrypt the virtual machine's virtual TPM data, we're going to store those in a physically separate location, and we're only going to give those to a virtual machine if the Hyper-V installation can first pass a series of health checks. You know, if the Hyper-V installation can verify that it hasn't been compromised in any way, shape, or form, and it passes all the health checks, then we'll release the keys so that virtual machines can start. And this gives you the final level of protection that if someone has gone in there and maybe disabled shielding or made some change that's not supported or there's been a compromise, then when a virtual machine goes to start on that, the host guardian service can come in and say, no, we're not going to let those virtual machines start. So these three things come together to give an amazingly secure environment where it has been our goal to start to meet some of the government regulations that exist around, you know, protection of data, even when in a cloud environment. I also showed you the secure boot support for Linux. As I said, this is something that we've been working with the community on. It's being rolled out through the different Linux distributions. Right now, Ubuntu 14.04 and later, and SUSE Enterprise Server 12 and later, both have support for this. We're waiting for it to roll out through the different distributions, but you can have secure boot with these environments. So that was security. The next thing is isolation. Unfortunately, I'm going to have to skip the demo here because the state of my laptop, I know this demo isn't going to work. But there are a couple of things that we've focused on isolation. And often when I talk about security and then isolation, I get people saying, well, aren't these the same thing? And the answer is no. Security is about ensuring that, you know, bad actors in your environment can't get access to the data that they shouldn't. Isolation is raising the bar another notch. Isolation is saying, okay, we want to make it so that, you know, someone who's misbehaving cannot even negatively affect the performance of other workloads in your environment. There are a couple of big investments that we've made here. The first one is storage costs. Now, in 2012 R2, we did a basic implementation of storage costs for the first time where you could go in and you could specify on virtual hard drives like, okay, here's a limit, here's a max. In 2016, we're making two key changes to this architecture. The first one is we're now allowing you to define shared storage cost policies. And what this means is if you imagine an environment where you have, you know, multiple users, you have multiple tenants, or maybe you have multiple applications that are combined, made up of a set of virtual machines. In 2012 R2, you had to go to each virtual machine and say, like, okay, you can get 500 IOPS, and you can get 1,000, and you can get 500. In 2016, you can actually define a policy where you say, okay, any virtual machine that is associated with this policy, the sum total of those virtual machines cannot exceed 5,000 IOPS. And then we will balance the workload amongst those virtual machines. So you could say, like, okay, like, man, those guys in engineering are real jerks. They always soak up all the storage resource. So I'm going to create a policy that says engineering sum total only gets 5,000 IOPS, and any of their virtual machines gets associated with that. And if one of their virtual machines starts using lots of IOPS, then it's their virtual machines that will suffer for that, and it won't affect the guys in finance. You know, and those are the sorts of scenarios that enables. The second thing that we've done is we've worked with the file server team to provide an integrated story for having these policies defined on the file server side. Well, why is that important? The reason why that's important is if you have a Hyper-V cluster where you have, a dozen Hyper-V servers connected to the same piece of storage on the back end, in order to effectively ensure the performance of storage, you need everyone to be aware of what's going on all the servers. There's no point in having one Hyper-V server being like, oh, I'm within my storage cost ranges, when another one is wildly off the charts. By having the storage cost policies on the file server, we have a single place where we can say, okay, we can guarantee that every virtual machine is treated fairly no matter what physical Hyper-V server they're running on. So unfortunately, I am going to have to skip over this demo. This is a great demo, lots of like pretty graphs and so on. Just like close your eyes and imagine that we're seeing it. That is one of the demos that isn't going to work because of the password changes. The second thing that we've done for the isolation tenant, this is actually probably a technology that, like, fingers crossed, you will never see this. But it's actually kind of cool. So what this is it's a technology that we call host resource protection. And this is actually something that we built for Azure. Because, and this is going to be the most surprising statement in the world, there are people out there who buy virtual machines from Azure with the sole intent of trying to hack us. I'm sure that surprises everyone here. Now, thankfully, they've never succeeded. But what's really annoying for us is that we get people in there trying to poke holes, and man, they can chew up a lot of resource doing that. It can actually be really disruptive from a performance point of view to the people around them on that server. And so what host resource protection is about is it's about us identifying, like, hey, there's a pattern of behavior in this virtual machine that looks like malicious activity. And what we're talking about here is if we see someone trying to go out and touch hardware registers that just don't exist in the virtual machine, or they're making invalid CPU calls, or they're doing activities that we know that an enterprise application would never do that. And if we see that behavior, we still can't be certain that this is guaranteed to be malicious. What we will do is we will just dynamically throttle back the CPU resource to just slow it down and stop it from disrupting the rest of the system. Now, if you ever do see this behavior in Hyper-V, you'll actually see in Hyper-V Manager, we'll have the little status flick up and say, host resource protection enabled. And there's a great story behind why we decided to put that flag in the UI. And that is because when we first checked this into the build, we actually broke Mark Rusinovich's demo setup. Mark Rusinovich travels around, does a lot of talks about malware hunting. And in his talks, he has a set of virtual machines which are just crammed full of all the nastiest malware in the world. And when we first put this into the build of Windows, we absolutely killed the performance of his demo. We got a panicked call from him being like, everything's running really slow. And it took us a while to figure out. It's like, that's good for us. That's the system working the way it's supposed to be. And also, largely to aid Mark, there is a registry key where you can turn this off should you be a malware researcher and you don't want your virtual machines running slow. So the next area of investment has been availability. This is always a big area of investment for us. And to me, availability is simply anything we can do to keep virtual machines running. So the first one, and this is one of my favorite features by far, is storage resiliency. And this is, I get to have a lot of fun conversations with customers. I'm also often the guy who has the not fun conversation. And when we were planning Windows Server 2016, I actually spent a lot of time going around and meeting customers who, when they met me, were very happy, and when I left, they weren't very happy. Because I'd meet them, and they'd be talking about how they were doing private cloud computing and how life was great and everything. And I would say, great. When was the last time you had a complete cloud outage in your environment? And they'd be like, about 9 months ago. Okay, tell me what happened. Step me through that. We actually spent a lot of time researching what was causing cloud outages, what was causing these events. And there were two things that accounted for like 95% of cloud outages. The number one thing was firmware bugs in storage. You know, the number one thing was like everything, like I have storage that works fine and beautifully for 364 days of the year. Unfortunately, the year is 365 days long, and for one day of the year, my storage just isn't happy every now and then. And this is actually the number one outage cause that we see. And usually when you have these issues, what happens is for a minute, for 5 minutes, for half an hour, for some relatively short period of time, the storage just stops responding. Now, in 2012 R2, when that happens, what will happen is as the virtual machine's running, the guest operating system will try and write something to disk, we'll try and write it down to the real storage will time out, we'll return the timeout up to the guest operating system, and the guest operating system, 9 times out of 10, does the only reasonable thing it can do and crashes. It goes, meh, disk gone, crash. And there's not much else you can do if you're an operating system and you can't write to the disk. But the problem that happens, and I've talked to a number of customers about this, is that then what happens is, you know, a 10-minute storage outage becomes a 3-day recovery. You know, because they have a 10-minute storage outage and they have 700 virtual machines crash. And when the storage comes back, 400 of those virtual machines boot up just fine. And 300 of those virtual machines are now days of triage, trying to figure out, you know, what's happening. So with storage resiliency, what we do is we're running along, the guest is writing, we're writing to the disk. When we see that first timeout event, when we see like we tried to write and something didn't work, we grab that before it gets sent to the guest. And we go, wait. And we actually pause the virtual machine, and so it's now offline, it's not responding, but it has not crashed. And we pause the virtual machine, and we then go into a mode where we're pulling the storage, waiting for it to come back. And when that storage comes back, we replay the request that timed out, and if that succeeds, we unpause the virtual machine, and it keeps on running like nothing happened. The great thing here is we're now talking about something that was a huge catastrophic event is now reduced to things went offline for 10 minutes and came back automatically. So that's really exciting. The second, though, I mentioned there were two things that caused cloud outage. The first one was storage failure. The second one was, and anyone who's worked in IT has experienced this. So let's do it. I like this one. This is a show of hands. How many people here have had the experience where you're at work, life's good, you know, all the systems are working, and one afternoon, for no reason whatsoever, the network just goes away. Just goes away. Like, ping doesn't work, packets aren't flowing. And 2 minutes later, the network's back. And you don't know what happened. But this happens. We have data. We have customers. We've talked to someone. But there's a million small things that can cause it to happen. But it does happen. Just every now and then, the network goes away, and you can spend months tuning and looking at firmware and getting drivers and so on, and it can still happen. And when that happens today in a 2012 R2 cluster, if the network goes away, the cluster panics. You know, the cluster's like, oh, dear Lord. And so what we've actually done in 2016 is we've built in a layer of resiliency into the cluster where we say, if the network goes away and it is just a network outage and there are no other indicators to say that there's a bigger problem, just wait a moment. Just see if the network comes back before you start turning off VMs and trying to start them elsewhere. So the default setting we have for this is we will wait for 4 minutes. And if after 4 minutes it hasn't come back, then we'll resume our normal behavior, and you can configure that. But the default is 4 minutes. And so this allows us to get through a lot of events that would have been catastrophic in the past. The second part of this, though, and I actually really like this feature, both because it has a silly name. Only engineers would come up and say, we need to solve the problem with flapping nodes. God bless them. But one of the things that we looked at while we were doing, and as I said, we did a lot of analysis of, you know, what causes outages and downtime in cloud environments. And one of the things that we found that was most destructive is this behavior that we call a flapping node. And a flapping node is basically, let's say you have a cluster and you have a single node in the cluster where maybe there's some hardware issue with one of the network adapters, or maybe there's a damaged network cable or something. And it keeps on coming and going. You know, and like every 20 minutes it has a little panic and goes off the network and then it comes back. And this is, as I said, this is one of the most destructive things, because every time that happens, we do a like reshuffle of the virtual machines and we try and figure out what's happening, and then we're like, oh, it's back, it's good, and we move virtual machines on there. You know, and then 20 minutes later, it goes away again. So what we now actually do is we keep a historic record of how frequently every node in a cluster has left and rejoined the cluster. And if we see a node in a cluster leave and rejoin a cluster more than 3 times in an hour, the next time it comes back, we'll say, we don't trust you anymore. We're putting you in quarantine. And when it comes back, we'll actually live migrate all the virtual machines off, and we'll put it in quarantine. Now, you can configure a lot of the parameters around when we put things into quarantine or not. You can also configure whether we automatically recover from quarantine. So you can, if you're running really large scale clusters, you can say like, okay, put things into quarantine with this policy, and when it, like, if you then see that this node is well behaved for 24 hours, bring it back in. You know, so there's a lot of control and flexibility here. The final thing that we've worked on is building an entirely new backup infrastructure. One of the big pieces of feedback that we've heard from customers is that our current backup infrastructure works great for a small number of Hyper-V servers, but it does not scale to cloud scale. So we've been doing a lot of work in changing the way backup works to make it so that, and to not go into the gory details, but if you're using Hyper-V with SANs and SAN-based backup today, basically, as you scale up your cloud, you scale up the number of snapshots that we take on the SAN, and you scale up the stress that we're putting on the SAN. With the new architecture, as you scale up the number of virtual machines, you don't change the number of SAN snapshots you take. So it allows us to be a lot more reliable as you continue to scale up. So that's something, so I know if we are working with all of our backup partners. I would really encourage, if you're evaluating 2016, talk to your preferred backup partner and see where they're at. I've talked to so many of them, I would be genuinely surprised if there is still a backup partner out there that doesn't know about the new technology that's coming here. So the next thing, and there's a warning, there's a whole bunch of things we've done for availability, is we've done some work on shared VHDX improvements. So shared VHDX is functionality that we shipped in Windows Server 2012 R2. And it allows you to do production-grade guest clusters using a VHDX file instead of having, you know, a fiber channel or iSCSI LAN. Now, when we did this in 2012 R2, the experience you got was identical, i.e., there are a lot of drawbacks to doing a guest cluster. You know, you can't, you know, do host-based backup. You can't do a lot of the features that you're used to with virtual machines. So it is our goal that eventually a guest cluster will have the same functionality as a standalone virtual machine. Now, we're not getting there in Server 2016, but we're getting down that road. So a couple of the key things that we're enabling host-based backup of guest clusters. We're enabling Hyper-V replica for guest clusters. We're also enabling online resize of shared VHDX files attached to guest clusters. I will put a small call out here. We've made some UI changes to Shared VHDX because a lot of people never realized we've always supported hot add and remove of Shared VHDX. It was just really unintuitive in the UI. So often when I'm demoing this, I will hot add a Shared VHDX file, and people will be like, wait, that's a new feature. And it's like, no, it isn't. You could actually do it with 2012 R2. It's just a lot of people didn't realize it. So now, unfortunately, I do have to skip over this demo. All the things I was just talking about rely on clustering, and all my clusters are broken because all the passwords reset. So I apologize. I will have some more demos in a moment. So that's a lot of the stuff that we traditionally think about when we think availability. But on the Hyper-V team, when we think availability, we think anything that causes someone to turn off a virtual machine. And often, turning off a virtual machine is something that you do manually because there's an activity that you want to do that requires you to turn it off. So we're working on taking all those away. So some of the big ones that we've changed in 2016, you can now hot add and remove network adapters from virtual machines. You can hot add and remove memory from virtual machines that don't have dynamic memory enabled. And you can hot add and remove virtual hard disks to virtual machines that are being replicated and control what happens with Hyper-V replica in all those cases. So this one I can demo, thankfully. Always bums me out when I can't do all my demos. So let's jump over here, wake up my mouse. Let's have a look at my demo script. Yeah, it's not coming back. That's so sad. Basically, for some reason, I have some scale-out file servers, and they are not starting. And so any of my demos that rely on scale-out file server aren't working. So let's pull up this virtual machine. See if I can remember my password. Yay! So this is just a Generation 2 virtual machine running Windows 10. The hot add and remove of network adapters works with any Generation 2 virtual machine. The hot add and remove of memory, it needs to be a Windows 10 or Windows Server 2016 guest. But so I have virtual machine with single network adapter, and I can come in here and add a network adapter. And add a network adapter. I actually like doing this. Whenever I do this demo, I add a million network adapters because we spent a bunch of time working on this because if you think about it, in the physical world, you cannot simultaneously add 5 network adapters to a physical computer. So we actually found some interesting bugs doing this. But that will, yay! Yeah, we had to work with the networking team on this because we found that if we added too many network adapters at once, that the plug-and-play engine would freak out because it'd be like, someone just hot-plugged like 10 devices into the computer at once, and how's that even possible? So you've just seen, like, I added half a dozen network adapters, and they came up, and they're all connected, and great. And similarly, I can go, okay, that was a bit over the top, and I'm going to remove them all at once. Yay. Oh, error. So I got demo. There we go. So there, how to remove network adapters, nice and easy. But I actually really like this feature. Now, show of hands, how many people here are using dynamic memory in their environments today? Okay, and others aren't. So I'd say about 50-50 for the people here. One of the things that I actually really like about this feature is, yes, we do allow you to do dynamic memory configuration, but what's actually really cool for everyone out there who has workloads where you're not using dynamic memory is now if I come here and I go to the memory tab, even though this virtual machine is configured with static memory, we show the memory demand information. And that's really cool because it allows you to go in and see, like, hey, did I correctly size the memory? Am I wasting memory? And it's a really good tool for just tuning the memory. Now, I'm going to show you this. I will say there is one bug here, and the bug is this number doesn't always change. These numbers change, this number down here and this number over here. So as I'm doing this, I want you to look at these two numbers, not this one. But this is nice and simple. We allow you to change in both directions. You can change down. And you see, these numbers changed that one, didn't I? And we changed down the amount of memory. You can change up, and you can do this easily all day long. We do have one feature. When you remove memory from the virtual machine, we actually have this kind of negotiation with the memory manager inside the virtual machine where we're trying to take away memory and it's trying to figure out if it can give us memory. So sometimes you'll ask us to drop the memory lower than we actually can, and we will do our best. So let's see if I can simulate this. Oh, it succeeded. That was supposed to fail. Let's go lower. How low can we go? Ah, that succeeded. This is terrible. Come on, give me a failure. Yay! And what you'll actually see, no, I didn't trigger it. If I do this right, we remove part of the memory. Because we'll actually, nope, I'm not getting it. If we have a situation where we try and remove memory and we get halfway through the process, and then it's like, okay, I can't remove anymore. We'll actually give you an error message that says like, hey, we got halfway through removing memory and we can't remove more memory. And we'll update the settings in the virtual machine to correctly show you how much memory it actually has. Let me throw this back up to 2 gig, make everyone happy, and move on to the next thing to talk about. So the final thing with availability is we've done a huge amount of work to support rolling upgrade in a cluster. This is actually something I'm really excited about. Going from a 2012 R2 to a 2016 cluster, you'll now be able to do this with zero downtime, no new hardware. It is such an easy process. The process that you go through is basically you take your existing cluster, you evacuate a node in the cluster, you remove it from the cluster, you upgrade it from 2012 to R2 to 2016, you join it back in, and you can now move virtual machines back and forth. And you then go through that whole process, and you upgrade all the nodes in your cluster. And when everything's upgraded, then there's a step to upgrade the cluster functional level where you go, okay, all the nodes are upgraded. I want to use the new 2016 features. And that's also a zero downtime operation. So as I said, the great thing is it's zero downtime, no new hardware needed. It's a very easy process to work with. We've actually been working very closely with the SCVMM team. They're providing orchestration and tooling for this as well. And actually, the biggest thing, and let me just do show of hands. How many people are on Hyper-V 2012 R2? How many people have deployments of earlier versions, 2012, 2008, R2? So the big thing I have to say to anyone who's got earlier versions, because another conversation I've had is people going like, oh, I'm not sure if I should upgrade to 2012 R2, maybe I should wait to 2016. It's like, no, upgrade to 2012 R2, because it's really easy to upgrade from 2012 R2 to 2016. You know, so get that out of the way and done today so that when 2016 comes out, you're in a great position to adapt the technology. Now, in order to enable rolling cluster upgrade, we've actually done a bunch of changes to the way virtual machine upgrade works behind the covers. Now, prior to 2016, whenever you upgraded Hyper-V and you bought in a virtual machine, we would automatically upgrade that virtual machine. Like, we would automatically upgrade it, make it latest, greatest, so on, but also make it incompatible with previous versions of Hyper-V. Now, in 2016 and Windows 10, we don't do that. When you bring in a virtual machine, we leave the version as is. Now, the downside is it means that on that virtual machine, you can't use any of the new features. The upside is we keep that 100% compatible with previous versions. So you can live migrate, you can have checkpoints, you can have save states, you can import, export, you can move that virtual machine back to a 2012 R2 server without any problems. Now, if there comes a point in time where you're like, okay, on this virtual machine, I want to use new functionality, you can upgrade it. We have a button in the UI. We also have a PowerShell command, and you can upgrade the virtual machine version. Two things I'd like to call out about this, though. The first one is And I get a lot of questions about this. We fully support version 5, which is the version for 2012 R2. We fully support version 5 virtual machines on 2016 long-term for production. You know, if you're running in a mixed environment or so on, we don't have any statement where we're like, oh, we support version 5, but you should really upgrade in under a month. No. No, you can keep version 5 for as long as it makes sense for you. That is fine. The second thing, this is actually something that we just flighted in the latest Windows 10 Insider build. Windows 10 Insider build, we've actually now added a parameter to the new virtual machine PowerShell commandlet where we allow you to create a new version 5 virtual machine on Windows 10, which is actually really nice if, like me, you have a Windows 10 desktop, but you have 2012 R2 servers. So now you can go and build virtual machines new on your Windows 10 desktop and export them and move them to 2012 R2 servers, and that all works seamlessly. So unfortunately, another demo that's broken because my cluster isn't working. So the second last area I want to talk through is what I like to call operational improvements. And that is a terrible name. My team accuses me of being great at coming up at meaningless names. And this is a meaningless name. These are all the things that don't necessarily tie into a big vision-y thing, but they just make you happy on a daily basis. You know, this is the stuff that we know users do and we know frustrate users, and it can make people happy on a daily basis. So the first one, I'm really excited about this one, is production checkpoints. Another show of hands moment. How many people here use checkpoints, virtual machine checkpoints? How many of you use them on your production servers? Not as many as I was expecting. You know we don't support that today. So I have the story I have here. So checkpoints is one of my features. It's always been one of my features. And when we were doing the first release of Hyper-V, we were going over the design of checkpoints, and there were a number of things that were there which were like, this is going to be a problem if someone does this on a production SQL server. And we're like, okay, what we're going to do, like, we understand there are important scenarios. We'll put the feature in there, and we will document everywhere that, like, this is for development and test, this is not for production, not for production, not for production, not for production. So we ship the first version of Hyper-V, and 6 months later, we're going over the support call data, and the number one support call generator was people using checkpoints in production. Because everyone was doing it, because it's so convenient. So over the last couple of releases, we've been slowly working on improving checkpoints and addressing issues to try and get it ready for production environments. Well, in 2016, we finally have checkpoint technology, which we are happy to say, yes, you can use this in production, and we fully support it, and it is safe for all production workloads. So that's really exciting. And what we've done is we give you exactly the same checkpoint experience that you get today in 2012 R2, but we're actually using VSS inside the virtual machine to take a production-safe checkpoint of the virtual machine. So the next feature under operational improvements is PowerShell Direct. This is a really cool feature. How many people here use PowerShell? Yay! Everyone, fantastic. How many people here have set up and used PowerShell remoting? Yeah. How many people? That was more than I was expecting. That was about 50%. How many people enjoyed setting up PowerShell remoting? Okay, that group sitting back there, I'm deeply concerned. We have a group of 5 people in a row there who all enjoy setting up PowerShell remoting. I'm worried. Keep an eye on them. I'm not. Setting up PowerShell remoting isn't easy, and it isn't fun. I'm sorry. What PowerShell Direct allows us to do is it allows you to connect to PowerShell sessions inside a virtual machine without setting up PowerShell remoting, without having networking, just straight from the host being able to go run this PowerShell command in that virtual machine, please. And it is really simple and really easy, and it allows you to do some amazingly powerful scripts and automation stuff. This has made my demo setups 100 times easier, except when all my credentials change. So the next one is REFS acceleration. This is really cool. I'll demo this and I'll talk about this, but we've been working on REFS for a while now. Windows Server 2016 is really the first time where we're going to be going out and saying, hey, for your Hyper-V servers, you should be using REFS. And assuming my demo behaves, I'll show you why in just a moment. The final thing that we've done is we've done a bunch of work on making Hyper-V Manager work better in different environments. So we've added support for alternate credentials. We've added support for connecting using IP addresses instead of names. A whole bunch of things where there were a bunch of scenarios where before Hyper-V Manager wasn't the greatest tool to use. So I'm going to jump across and try and make, I'm just thinking through these demos. I think I'm just going to focus on the REFS demo because everything else is pretty broken. I'm going to have to kill this script. OK. Let's see if my REFS demo works. So I'm going to start. This is a script I have. I have a representative production grade storage system here. It's this USB drive. So I have this USB drive has two partitions on it. One's REFS formatted, one's NTFS formatted. So it's the same hardware that's being used in both cases. And I'm going to start by creating a 1 gigabyte fixed VHD on an NTFS volume. And I like to do this. Like, how many people here have created a fixed-size VHD with Hyper-V that's over a terabyte in size? Show of hands. OK, we've got a couple of people. Over 5 terabyte? What size fixed VHD have you created? ODX, that's cheating. That's cheating. The largest one that I've created without ODX was a 5 terabyte VHD. And without ODX, creating a 5 terabyte fixed VHD took about 22 hours. Because when we create a fixed VHD on NTFS, we go through and we write out all the data. We go to every block and we write out 0000000. So creating a 1 gigabyte drive on this just took 26 seconds. So let's see REFS, same volume, same physical hardware, just REFS formatted, 1 second. So OK, what about a 50 gig? 1 second. And the reason that that's so fast is because NTFS doesn't have any intelligence about virtual hard drives. So in order to get a virtual hard drive full of zeros, we have to create a file, and we have to go through and 00000. REFS has a whole layer of intelligence where we can go to REFS and say, can you please give us a 50 gig file that's backed by zeros? And REFS goes, why, yes, here it is. So the next thing I want to show you, and I've just realized because my script is broken, I have to do a quick spot of manual setup. So just hang in here. I believe, yes. So if I let me look at my setup script, because I needed to, that setup script is supposed to copy these files in here, but because it's all broken, we copy them into, this is what we want. Let's just grab this code. Making my demo up as we go. So this is just copying these files across. So the next demo, when this completes, is I'm going to show you the difference between file merge. So we have a technology which is differencing disks. We use it everywhere throughout the system. Obviously, you can create differencing disks. But whenever you create a checkpoint or if you use Hyper-V replica, we create differencing disks in order to do that. We also use them in backup. Now, the problem with differencing disks is when we need to merge the changes in. So I'm going to go in and I'm going to merge the changes, and I've copied the same base disk and differencing disk onto both locations. And I'm going to do a merge on NTFS. And this is really awkward. I will just say, side note, we have a bug in the progress dialog in PowerShell for merge. So when it gets to about 3%, it's actually about 90%. So don't panic. You're going to be sitting here while I'm talking and being like, oh my goodness, it only just got to 2%. This is going to take forever. What happens when we do a merge on NTFS is we are going through and reading all the blocks and writing all the blocks that are different. So that took 29 seconds because we read and we wrote all the blocks. With REFS merging the same disk, 2 seconds. And the reason why that happens is, once again, REFS has the intelligence to understand that, like, oh, we have a base disk, which is a collection of blocks on the hard drive. We have a differencing disk, which is a collection of blocks on the hard drive. And we're able to go to REFS and say, give us the union of these two things. And it creates a new file description that just references the right blocks. So the cool thing about this is not only is it much faster, but it causes much less I/O to happen. When you do the merge on NTFS, we're actually reading and writing a whole bunch of data. When you do the merge on REFS, we don't. So that's pretty cool. I like that. So jumping back, the final thing I like to talk about is enhancing the platform. And this is some of the really deep in the architecture stuff that we did. So the first thing, we've made a bunch of configuration changes. Now, normally, we actually, in pretty much every release, we make changes to how we store virtual machine configuration. And we normally don't talk about it. The main reason why I'm talking about this time is we're actually changing the file format. We've gone from an XML file to a binary format. We have the .vmcx file and the .vmrs file. We actually did this for two reasons. The first reason was, as I mentioned way back in the availability section, we've spent a lot of time talking to people about the problems that they have in their environment. And one of the problems that came up was people getting corrupted virtual machine configuration files. And so we've changed to a format that has resilient logging characteristics in it. The second thing, and no one believes me when I say this, it is true, I need to do a blog post to show all the performance analysis, but when we start running at cloud scale, just reading, writing, updating virtual machine configuration files that are XML-based ends up using a surprising amount of CPU. I've actually got studies where, like, even at reasonable scales, if we have 100 virtual machines with Hyper-V replica enabled, we end up using almost an entire CPU core just reading and writing changes to configuration files because we're going through the XML libraries. Moving to a binary format drastically reduces our CPU usage while doing these configuration accesses. The next thing is a bunch of Hyper-V hypervisor power management improvements, and I could spend 20 minutes drawing the architectural diagram and explaining everything that we did, but I like to use this little animation instead. This is actually a whole bunch of people tweeting about, hey, what the heck, I enabled Hyper-V on my Surface 3, and now the battery life is gone. And the one that really burns is this last tweet here. Because if you see, that is actually the official Microsoft Surface Twitter account telling someone they should turn off Hyper-V in order to get better battery life. That hurts. So the issue is, in Windows 8.1, we introduced a new power-saving technology called Connected Standby, which unfortunately wasn't compatible with the Hyper-V hypervisor. In Windows 10 and Windows Server 2016, Technical Preview 3, Connected Standby works. We've done a bunch of work to improve remote effects. How many people are doing VDI with Hyper-V? It's those strange people who like PowerShell remoting. I'm not sure I can trust them anymore. We've done a bunch of work to improve remote effects, raise the capabilities and the standards there. A fun thing, I actually haven't got around to blogging about this. This is in my backlog. In the latest Windows 10 Insider build, we are now enabling remote effects on Hyper-V on Windows 10. So if you want to play with 3D accelerated graphics in a virtual machine on your desktop, you absolutely can do that. One last thing, I'm so excited about this for people who follow the Insider Build. We have released our first preview of nested virtualization. So you can now run Hyper-V inside of Hyper-V. It is the greatest thing ever. The first day I got a Hyper-V cluster running on my laptop was amazing. So this was just a week and a half ago. The latest build of Windows 10, we now allow you to run Hyper-V inside of Hyper-V. That is going to be in the next Windows Server technical preview. It is a great tool for people doing test and evaluation, but it's also something that we've enabled so that we can start doing cool things like running Hyper-V containers in the Azure public cloud. So with all that said, lots of stuff to try out. This is all available for you to play with. Please do so. We'd love to hear feedback. Please try it out. Please, you know, feel free to hassle me, Virtual PC Guy. That's my Twitter account. You can also email me, virtualpcguy@microsoft.com, and it will get to me. And we have the forums. We're also big fans of the Windows Server user voice. So if there's anything that you like or hate, please let us know. Before I open for questions, I do just want to do a call out and say we're having the Microsoft Azure tour in Stockholm in November, and we're trying to get as many people there as possible. It's going to be really fun. We're going to step you through a lot of the details and the capabilities of Azure. So with that, we're actually 1 minute over, but I'm happy to take any questions that people have. No questions? So this is annoying, because what happens is I turn off my mic, and I know people are going to walk up and ask me questions. So come on, someone ask a question. No? Oh, we have one over here. Thank you. Sorry, I couldn't hear you. So he was asking if we could, I had a slide where I said that we would limit the number of running nodes that would go into quarantine in a cluster to 25%. You were asking if that could be configured? Yes. In fact, everything, it's not in the UI, but everything about the cluster resiliency and the quarantine behavior, we allow you to configure almost everything there through PowerShell, because we understand that depending on people's environments, the right setting is going to be very different from those. So I'd encourage you, if you go look at the, if you are evaluating TP3, just look at the cluster property, the properties on the cluster object in PowerShell. There's a whole long list of them that are about VM resiliency and quarantine. I was waiting for people to. So the question was, the nested virtualization thing, will that extend to other hypervisors? And I am going to say yes and no and meh. So the yes is, we actually, so our primary motivation for nested was to do Hyper-V on Hyper-V. And we actually sat down and we looked at a whole bunch of engineering approaches to it. And we were actually surprised to figure out that the most efficient way for us to enable Hyper-V on Hyper-V was for us to enable any virtualization platform on Hyper-V. So from an architectural point of view, we think we've enabled any virtualization platform on Hyper-V. That said, we certainly have not tested a lot of them. We've been focused on Hyper-V on Hyper-V. I know I've had at least one person blog about, hey, they tried VMware Workstation in a nested environment on the platform, and it worked. So if you have a virtualization platform of choice that you would like to try, I would love it if you try it out and hit me up on Twitter and be like, hey, we tried this, it worked, or it didn't work. Eventually, we do want to support everything, but our number one goal right now is Hyper-V. That said, as I said, architecturally, we believe that most of them are going to work. So the question, actually, that was in the slide. You didn't read the slide. Look, third bullet point. Seems. Yes. So I am 4 minutes over time now, so I'm going to wrap up. Thank you, everyone. I hope you enjoyed the presentation.